Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Affney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. Well, there has been a providential development that we're anxious to talk about, and we're going to do so with one of our favorite guests. His name is Jonathan Emord. He is a constitutional attorney by trade, an author of, among other things, The Authoritarians, a book that has as its subtitle, Their Assault on Individual Liberty, the Constitution, and Free Enterprise from the 19th Century to the Present. He is also a man who is currently a candidate for the United States Senate in the Commonwealth of Virginia, and we're always pleased to catch up with him, but especially in connection with a matter of great constitutional import, and really, I think, for pushing back against the authoritarian administrative state, unaccountable, unelected, and generally very problematic. Jonathan Emord, it's good to have you with us. Welcome back, sir.
Great to be with you.
I wanted to ask you, if you could, to just tell us about this court ruling by the Supreme Court that has, as I say, potentially some very profound implications.
It's really a momentous decision, the Axon decision just handed down recently last Friday. The decision is a stark break from extraordinary deference that has been applied to administrative agency decisions really since the 1930s. The standard way of operating has been for the federal courts to refuse to hear a case brought by a party at the start of an administrative proceeding on the basis that the administrative proceeding would have to be exhausted first, the exhaustion doctrine it's called. And so what this has done is caused people to spend an enormous amount of money defending themselves, even when they raise constitutional arguments in their defense, through the entire administrative process. And the result of that oftentimes is bankruptcy for parties that are accused without ever having them reach federal court. That is exacerbated by the problem that the administrative state denies people their constitutional rights in the whole process. So it's a kangaroo court kind of environment.
Yeah. For those who haven't been subjected to this kangaroo court proceeding, just put into sort of the broader context, what are these administrative courts and how do they have standing to essentially exercise judicial authority?
So the agencies possess oftentimes combined legislative, executive, and judicial power. And the administrative law judges are employees of the agency that is bringing the charges against the accused. As a result, they don't ordinarily have definitive power to decide. They issue what are known as recommendations to the charging body, the commission, ordinarily. So what happens is charges are brought by the commission. So the commission is then the prosecutor. But the commission is also the judge. So you have the prosecutor also being the ultimate judge. Administrative law judge has the role of writing a recommendation. Now, the upshot of that is that most frequently the recommendations are overruled if they are in the favor of the accused, because again, the ultimate judge is the commission. Mm-hmm. So, James Madison described this as the very definition of tyranny in the Federalist Papers.
Sure sounds like it.
It is. And in fact, the accused in an administrative proceeding is presumed guilty until they prove themselves innocent. Hmm. Moreover,
is the antithesis of the rule of law under this Constitution, is that not
right? It is. And the accused are also denied discovery against their accuser. They cannot engage in discovery against the government. The government, by contrast, has plenary discovery against the accused. In fact, the general warrants that are prohibited by the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution in Article III courts are used every day by administrative courts. And the effect is devastating because they can ask for any amount of information and they can extend those warrants to non-parties who do business with the party that is accused. And what frequently happens is it's used as a weapon to destroy the business of the accused so they can't defend themselves.
Jonathan, it seems like there's a lot wrong with this whole process, from a constitutional point of view, not least, to say nothing of fairness and, you know, equal rights and so on. But what has the court ruled, and how does it bear on the future of perhaps all of these administrative proceedings?
So the court has ruled that a party can bring a constitutional challenge to an administrative agency's action in federal court at the start of the administrative proceeding. That is profound because that enables a party that is being harassed, abused, and unconstitutionally victimized by an administrative agency of the federal government to be forced to account for its actions in the first instance to a court. One step more would be ideal, and that is to abolish the ability of the administrative agencies to proceed independent of an Article III court, forcing them to live by the same constitutional strictures and respect the same constitutional rights that are afforded in a federal independent court under Article III. That's what the Founding Fathers intended. There is no provision in the Constitution, certainly no intention whatsoever, quite the contrary, of the founders to invest magistrates independent of the Article III courts with a power to decide the fate of the property and the lives and the liberty of anyone.
Yeah, well, especially in ways that are antithetical, as I say, to how those Article III courts, the normal, you know, federal courts, are to operate. And Jonathan, so I'm clear about this. The Axon Enterprises versus Federal Trade Commission decision by the Supreme Court would seem to be the answer to a awful lot of Americans' prayers, even if it doesn't go quite as far as you suggest it might. What kind of response has there been from the deep state, the administrative state, this permanent bureaucracy, and its entities like these administrative courts?
I would have to say they're shocked and appalled.
They are.
Because their power has been truncated rather significantly. This was a 9-0 decision.
No kidding. I was going to ask you what the vote was. Wow.
And as a result, it is definitive, and it is, you know, what this tells us very clearly is that the justices of the Supreme Court have gotten the message that the abuses are so profound in the administrative state and are so ruinous to people that not even the liberal defenders, ordinarily the defenders of the administrative state, are willing to tolerate disallowing people the right to challenge the agencies in the first instance in federal court. So it is a day for celebration.
Indeed, praise God. And I mean, the fact that you had those liberals on the court, albeit in a minority of a mind on this, is really extraordinary indeed. Do you think that you will see in future cases efforts made to extend the thrust of this ruling in the way that you've just described would be ideal?
Yes, I think so. I hope so. I know the lower federal courts will play with this for a time, and the Supreme Court is likely to revisit it a number of times to get it right. But I think their message is very clear. There will be judges in the lower federal courts who will probably try to avoid the full impact of this. But this sends a very clear message. If you have a constitutional right that is being violated by an administrative agency, you need not go through their wretched kangaroo court processes, but you go straight to federal court and challenge
it. And have your rights protected in the Article III process.
Right.
Jonathan, we have to take a short break. We'll be right back with more good news, I hope, on the other side of this very short break. Jonathan Emord, the author of The Authoritarians, is with us. Stay tuned.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The Food and Drug Administration announced last week that in the interest of simplifying the vaccination schedule for most individuals, the original monovalent Pfizer and Moderna COVID jabs are, quote, no longer authorized for use in the United States, unquote. Even though the FDA doesn't acknowledge that these so-called vaccines don't work and have actually proven to be harmful, it's hard to read this statement as anything but a tacit admission that the emergency and mandatory use of those experimental gene therapies was a mistake. Undeterred, the agency is now calling for bivalent mRNA vaccinations instead. In an important webinar this afternoon about the next plandemic, an expert on pharmaceutical clinical trials named Sasha Latipova will expose how these gene therapies are actually biological weapons and developed as such outside the necessary regulatory and experimental process. Catch the webinar and learn more at stopvaxpassports.org. This is Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We're visiting with Jonathan Immord, a constitutional scholar and attorney, a man who has written a marvelous book about challenges that we're facing. We'll talk more about them in a moment, entitled The Authoritarians. But he's also a candidate for the United States Senate in the Commonwealth of Virginia. Jonathan, I wanted just to wrap up that previous conversation. I understand that the author of this 9-0 decision is a rather unlikely one. Tell us who wrote it and whether, as we were discussing earlier, that might portend important changes, especially in light of some previous decisions of the court with respect specifically to the Federal Trade Commission.
So Justice Kagan wrote the decision for the court. The court, actually, this
one is one of those liberals.
Yes. And this is a combined decision that deals not only with the FTC, but also with a very similar case at the SEC. On the FTC side, this is really another whack at the FTC, because earlier the Supreme Court had ruled that the FTC assumed power to fine parties, impose financial redress penalties on them that was not permitted by statute. So they struck that power by saying that, gee, that was an assumption of power beyond the statutory authorization. So that the FTC has gotten itself.
But that's what bureaucrats do. If they've got an opportunity, they will accrue more and more authority and more power.
And the court has been very liberal up to this point in allowing that. So to see nine justices, all nine, take this position tells you very clearly that they are greatly disturbed, angry at the excesses that have been taking place at the expense of individuals and businesses, and even so to the point that those justices that ordinarily would defend the administrative state no longer are willing to do that, at least to the extent of not allowing a party to go straight to court.
My recollection is Justice Kagan was a solicitor general, so she knows a thing or two about the bureaucracy in the Justice Department and beyond, I'm sure. Well, again, praise the Lord, and let's hope there's further building out of this and protections afforded to the American people that the founders had in mind in the Constitution. I wanted to turn to something else that is of great import for the Constitution of the United States. Jonathan, and I'm very pleased to say, as we speak, you will be shortly participating in a webinar of our Committee on the Present Danger, China, this afternoon. It is a program that is designed to call attention to what I call the global governance gambit. And it's coming to a head, I think, at the moment, or hopefully will soon, with respect to both the World Health Organization and the United Nations, of which the WHO is a subsidiary. Talk a little bit about this phenomenon of the agencies like this, the UN, the WHO, dominated by the Chinese Communist Party, promoting agendas, promoting an accruing of power, speaking of bureaucrats, international bureaucrats in this case, that would come at great expense to our sovereignty and security.
Well, this is part and parcel of a overall movement by the Chinese Communist Party to gain control over the world. And they are doing this by following their playbook, actually a playbook that was written all the way back 600 years BC in the first state of Qin, the warring state that actually ultimately acquired all of China. And that is a philosophy.
Qin, China.
Exactly.
Right.
And that is a philosophy that says you befriend your enemy, essentially. You identify their weaknesses in the process. You then exploit the weaknesses to reduce them in their strength. And then you either succeed in taking them over without a fight, or you've reduced them to such an extent that the fight will be manageable and victory assured. So that approach, described well in the 100-Year Marathon, I believe the book 100-Year Marathon, is underway. And with regard to these international organizations, just like with nation states that are receiving financial assistance initially for roads and bridges and telecommunications infrastructure.
The Belt and Road Initiative. Yeah.
Yes. The upshot of that ultimately is a strong arm push to force those countries into becoming satellites of communist China. This is also a similar move. You take over international organizations, which is not difficult. In the case of the World Health Organization, Tedros, who comes out of an authoritarian background himself, is a bosom buddy with Xi Jinping, and he's happy to do the bidding and has done the bidding consistently for the CCP. So here we have these international organizations which are being used to become vehicles for the destruction of the United States and the West, particularly the United States, and we ourselves are paying for them. And this is outrageous. We ought to call a spade and get out of these organizations.
I couldn't agree more. As troubling as is the fact that the Biden administration is colluding assiduously, as best I can tell, with the Chinese Communist Party and the World Economic Forum, and in the case of the World Health Organization, Bill Gates and Big Pharma, is the fact that the United States Senate, in a recent vote on an amendment sponsored by Senator Ron Johnson, declined to perform its constitutional duty to advise and consent to what are treaties as a practical matter. And I'd like to ask you to just address that in two ways, if you would, Jonathan. One is, why did the framers feel it so important to not only have the Senate involved in the treaty making process, but to set the bar so high that you had to get a 2/3 majority vote of the Senate in order to have consent and therefore then the ratification of the treaty? And secondly, what do you make of the fact that these guys are simply saying, you know, we're not going to do our job in that regard, with respect to the World Health Organization, at least?
Well, when it comes to the treaty-making power, the purpose the Founding Fathers intended for this body, the Senate, which was at the time a representative of the states, more particularly because state legislators would vote for senators until the amendment was passed that caused direct election of the Senate, the 17th Amendment. So what we ended up with at the start, and what was their clear intention, was that the states be represented by their individual United States senators and have a role to play in whether the United States would embroil itself in any international conflict. This came out of their understanding from the Revolutionary War and forward that entangling alliances with foreign powers could enable those foreign powers to manipulate and take over the United States and destroy the Republic. That's exactly what we have here going on. this is a quintessentially a matter that would have to be addressed as a treaty by the Senate of the United States. The changes that are contemplated and that are actually underway by the Biden administration are changes fundamental that have a dire impact on Americans' interests, and they deviate from the historic relationships that have existed in these international organizations. So as a consequence, a honest president, one who abided by the Constitution and understood the limits of his power or her power, would submit this to the Senate and get a two-thirds vote in order to proceed. By not doing it, it's a flagrant violation of the treaty clause. It is also excessive in the sense that anything that would invade the sovereignty of the states, ultimately readjusting the relationship between a doctor and a patient, is one that deprives the states of their powers under the Constitution over health and safety.
Jonathan, we have to leave it at that. Thank you for your time today. God bless you, my friend. Keep up great work and come back to us again soon. We'll be right back with more right after this.
In cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Back, and we are joined by one of our favorite guests. His name is Bill Marshall. He is the senior investigator at an incredibly important organization based in Washington, D.C. It's called Judicial Watch. Bill brings a wealth of experience both in government and in the private sector in investigating, but never with greater effect, I think it's probably fair to say, than the work that he does these days at Judicial Watch. And we wanted to catch up with him in connection with some of the latest evidence that he and his team have been pulling together about what has gone on with respect to, well, enabling a Chinese biological warfare attack against the United States. That's how I see it, anyway. And Bill, I'm anxious to hear how you see it. Welcome back, sir. Good to have you with us, as always.
Great to be back with you, Frank.
So, Bill, give us sort of the latest on Judicial Watch's investigations into the whole, well, creation of the Wuhan virus, the COVID pandemic's SARS-CoV-2 source.
Right. Well, you'll recall that Senator Rand Paul did a creditable job of interrogating Anthony Fauci about that would be the former director of the National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Disease, really one of the top guys in NIH for, 40 some odd years. He was funding, there's no question about this, NIH was funding research, you characterize as biowarfare research. I wouldn't disagree with you, but they certainly would characterize it differently. They would call it biodefense research. Okay. In any case, the NIH funded through a cutout through an organization called EcoHealth Alliance, funding for very dodgy research that was taking place, among other places, at the Wuhan Institute of Virology. And of course, this was, many suspect, where a lab leak may have occurred, which resulted in the spread of COVID-19 around the world. Now, they were collaborating. This was a grant made by NIH through EcoHealth Alliance in May of 2014 to the tune of $3 million for an initial five-year period. And what I obtained, what I asked for, we already had the original grant application from 2014. But in reviewing that, I realized that they had to submit an annual sort of report summarizing their research for every year that it was taking place. So I asked for those. And honestly, I was kind of shocked that nobody else apparently had thought to ask for these before. So I requested through a Freedom of Information Act in December of 2021. I asked for all these reports that EcoHealth was required to submit to NIH in conformity with their compliance with their grant application, with their grant. And they provided them to me, shockingly, without a lawsuit. It took them a year and 3 or 4 months, but we got these reports. And what these reports do is call into question to an even greater degree what it was we were funding over there. It, to my layman's, that is my non-scientific eye, it certainly looks, and in their own words, they basically state that they were creating viruses, mutant viruses, that were more infectious to human beings. These were bat viruses that China was collecting in a large virus collection operation. They were taking the backbone, if you will, of viruses that are found in bats and manipulating the spike protein deliberately on this what's called WIV, for WIV1, which is the name they assigned to the virus for Wuhan Institute of Virology, that they created with working with Ralph Barrett. This is a key figure, and I can't emphasize this enough. This is a brilliant, by all accounts, in a kind of a mad way, if you ask me, but a scientist at the University of North Carolina who runs the virology lab down there. He is like the godfather of gain-of-function research with human coronaviruses. He needs to be brought before Rand Paul, okay, and I would argue House Oversight Committee's hearings to testify as to his knowledge, along with the head of EcoHealth Alliance, Peter Daszak, and Anthony Fauci, and grilled about what they were doing with the Wuhan Institute of Virology, because Ralph Barrick is central to this story.
And the documentation, and this is, again, what we prize so much about the work of Judicial Watch, Bill, is the dogged way in which you extract, often very reluctantly, but nonetheless extract from government agencies the kind of information that you've just shared with us. In this particular case, and whether you describe it as biodefense or biowarfare, I think many of these techniques apply equally to both, and that's been one of the problems all along in this effort to try to prevent nations, well, like communist China, from pursuing offensive biowarfare capabilities, is that they've been able to some extent at least masquerade it as biodefense. But in the case of the Wuhan Institute of Virology, I think there's really no doubt, certainly at this point, that it's been involved in the offensive line of work of biowarfare. And to the extent that Ralph Barrick and Peter Daszak and Tony Fauci were involved or using U.S. government funds, for heaven's sakes, as well as apparently supplying American technology, this is aiding and abetting a mortal danger to our country, and we've just had a small taste of it in terms of this COVID pandemic, have we not?
Absolutely. Now, as you say, this is basically two sides of the same coin, this biowarfare and biodefense, okay? Because you can use almost any defensive technology offensively. What what I would argue, I mean, that's called dual research, dual use research of concern, DURC, is the sort of the term of art they use in this environment, in the defense sector. People need to understand the CIA and the role of the CIA and the U.S. Department of Defense in all of this research needs to be intensely scrutinized, okay? And I won't go into, you're very familiar with all the wargaming that they've done over the last 20 years, which is spelled out brilliantly in Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s book, The Real Anthony Fauci. But what you know, my concern is that they need to bring in experts like Richard Ebright, who's a tremendous professor, a biochemist at Rutgers University, who has been a longtime critic of this gain of function research area. Academic area. Basically, he says that gain of research is so dangerous because it's scientists in the academic, what he calls the academic ecosphere. It is fast, easy, fundable, and publishable. So there's a desire for academic scientists to use to delve into gain of function research, because it really benefits them in all kinds of ways, reputationally and financially and through other ways, with complete disregard for the dangers that it poses to the human species, you know, because you have there, and as we've discussed before, Frank, on your show, there have been numerous accidents taking place in many of these biosecurity labs that are conducting this research. And there are many of them around the world. I mean, now we're learning about, you know, recently in the last year or so, we've been learning about all the labs that were being run, these biosecurity labs that were being run in the Ukraine, you know, some of which Hunter Biden, of all people, was invested in. So, you know, this is these records, these reports add more light to what EcoHealth Alliance was doing with Ralph Baric at the UN, University of North Carolina, and the Wuhan Institute of Virology and other Chinese institutes in Guangdong, the Chinese Center for Disease Control, was another player in this. There was another pathogen institute in Shanghai that was being funded by NIH and through this grant as a subawardee in this program to conduct this biological research. And what they were doing again is they were creating chimeras. They were creating hybrid viruses using proteins from different viruses in addition to the original backbone of the WIV1 virus. They were making it more transmissible and dangerous to human beings. This is insane.
Of gain of function is to give it more transmissibility, more lethality perhaps. And why we would do this, yes, with our mortal enemy is just absolutely beyond me. But two things jump out at me here. One is there was, in fact, at the time, as I understand it, restrictions on doing this kind of research in the United States. I think the Obama administration had said, you know, this is too dangerous.
Yes.
And then, Bill, there's this question, as you said earlier, was the Defense Department, was the Central Intelligence Agency getting something from all of this beyond, you know, just sort of the obvious research work?
Well, one of the accomplishments noted in one of these annual reports was that the two central investigators in this grant, which would be Peter Daszak, who was what they call the primary investigator, the PI, and Xisheng Li, who was essentially his number two, who was the woman running the labs, another brilliant, you know, virologist.
Chinese, right?
Right, Chinese, who was running the Wuhan lab. They were briefing DARPA, okay, on the successes of their research. They actually,
the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. Bill, exactly. We are out of time, and we're leaving people hanging in suspense, because what they were briefing them and what was being done with all of this is vital for us to find more out about. We have to have you back very soon. Come back next week if you would.
We'll do.
Thank you for this report from Judicial Watch, Bill Marshall. God bless you. We'll be right back with more right after this.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The Food and Drug Administration announced last week that in the interest of simplifying the vaccination schedule for most individuals, the original monovalent Pfizer and Moderna COVID jabs are, quote, no longer authorized for use in the United States, unquote. Even though the FDA doesn't acknowledge that these so-called vaccines don't work and have actually proven to be harmful, it's hard to read this statement as anything but a tacit admission that the emergency and mandatory use of those experimental gene therapies was a mistake. Undeterred, the agency is now calling for bivalent mRNA vaccinations instead. In an important webinar this afternoon about the next plandemic, an expert on pharmaceutical clinical trials named Sasha Latipova will expose how these gene therapies are actually biological weapons and developed as such outside the necessary regulatory and experimental process. Catch the webinar and learn more at stopvaxpassports.org. This is Frank Affney.
Welcome back, and a very special welcome to a man I've known not well, but for a very long time. In fact, he shamed me into remembering something that took place some 25 years ago, and I'm having more and more trouble remembering what I had for breakfast, so this stretched me a bit. But his name is Rick Green. He is an extraordinary patriot. In fact, that patriotism has animated, I think, every aspect of his life, notably as a constitutional attorney, as a Texas state legislator, and now as the executive director of a tremendous operation called Patriot Academy. I'm thrilled that it now has a permanent facility for its vital training programs in Fredericksburg, Texas. And I've wanted Rick to come on for a while now, but especially to talk about the program, some of the training that he's doing that I think will be of great interest to our audience, and also why it's so important that we all get trained up. And Rick, it's good to have you with us. Welcome, my friend.
Hey, Frank. Good to be with you, brother.
Bless you for your work.
Yeah, man. Absolutely. Thrilled to be with you, and honestly thrilled to be in the fight at such a time as this. I'm a happy warrior, like Reagan said we should be, you know, and like he said, I'm glad we don't live in pale and timid times. We're at a time where what we're doing makes a difference, and we don't know, you know, where this is all going to end up, but I am thrilled to be able to be on the front lines with you.
Yeah, well, amen to that. And friends of mine say it's end times. I'm not sure whether it's that, but I think either way, there's some rough country ahead. So
yeah,
it's
agreed.
Vital that we be with girded loins, as they say, and you're doing a lot of that, Rick. Tell us a little bit about Patriot Academy, how long you've been in business, what you do with it, why it's important that you now have this wonderful facility in Fredericksburg.
Yeah. Well, like you said, this will be our first permanent home. We've been doing it 23 years. We started it back when I was in the state house in Texas, and our home was just whichever state capital we went to bring young people in, to give them an opportunity to be a legislator for a week and learn the process, learn to be good citizens, learn leadership skills. We sort of used the legislative laboratory, if you will, as a place where we could raise up a remnant of young people that really understand the value of freedom and value of being an American, and how important it was for them to be involved. And so our graduates are now all over the country. They serve in state legislatures and Congress. They're in business. They're in the pulpit. They're in entertainment and the arts. They're all over the culture, taking what we teach, the LIFT principles, limited government, individual liberties, free enterprise, and timeless truths, into whatever arena they happen to be in. So that's sort of been our shtick for 23 years. And then a few years back, I ran for state Supreme Court in Texas. And after that race, I had talked about the Constitution all throughout the campaign. Barely lost, by the way, one vote per precinct across Texas. But anyway, I'm not bitter. I'm over it. No, really. Anyway, so we ended up getting a lot of people interested in the Constitution, and people were asking me to come teach on the Constitution. And I'd start going to places. It was weird, Frank. I would go to these blue cities and blue states, Chehalis, Washington, and places in Massachusetts. And I mean, we would end up with a crowd that would spend all day on a Saturday walking through the entire Constitution with me. It shocked me. I did not expect people to do that. And of course, then I'd jump on social media and on Facebook. Back then, it was just getting big. And I would talk about, hey, we talked about executive orders today, and what's a constitutional one, what's an unconstitutional one. And then people would post and say, would you come to our town? And that just grew and grew and grew. And so then we started training other people to do it. And now, Frank, I'm excited to announce we have 24,000 Constitution coaches all over the nation now, and they're using the videos that we filmed at Independence Hall in the room where it was done, with all kinds of great people, Kirk Cameron and all kinds of people in there teaching. And they're using that in their homes, in their living rooms, in their churches, no kidding, in bait and tackle shops, in Harley Davidson dealerships. I mean, it's just everywhere. And so that's why, part of why I'm joyful and hopeful is that I'm seeing that awakening and that resurgence. And the reason we built the campus is because we needed a place where these young leaders, 16 to 25 is what we've been bringing into Capitals every year. We wanted 18 to 25 year olds to come spend a year instead of just 1 week, spend a year with us on campus instead of college, much better than college, get a good grounding in biblical worldview and constitutional governance and leadership skills and purpose, all of those things. And then if they need to do college for a particular career, very few of which I think needed at this point, but if they do, then great. We can help them get, 30 to 60 hours while they're there with us for that year. But the main thing is to really prepare them for leadership. And then the really fun part, and then I'll shut up, I'm going way too long here, but the really fun part is a 1 week Patriot experience. So we're rebuilding Independence Hall, rebuilding the rotunda of the U.S. Capitol, rebuilding Monticello. We're going to have a Patriot experience where people come to this campus, bring their family for 1 week. They get to do a handgun defense class if they want, really learn the Second Amendment. They get to be a legislator for 2 days in our legislative hall and learn from inside the belly of the beast what it's like. They get their Constitution training in the mock-up of Independence Hall. It's going to be an amazing experience for families to come in, really understand what it means to be an American, get motivated, get trained, and then go back to their community and be the catalyst for restoring constitutional principles and biblical values. I believe it's a game changer. Our supporters believe it's a game changer. We're doing our groundbreaking in just a few days. Lauren Boebert, one of our graduates of Constitutional Live, Congresswoman from Colorado, will be there, John Rich and others. And Frank, I couldn't be more excited, man. I really think God's going to use this as an inflection point to wake up a lot of people, but also to really train and equip them and give them hope and give them things they can actually do in their neighborhoods.
Fantastic. I can't imagine a better presentation of an obviously very consequential effort. And the fact that you think it will make a difference is informed by the fact that you know it has made a difference.
That's right.
Already.
That's right.
And the difference needs to be made. God knows. Just a quick question about the mock-ups. You're talking about building replicas of these hallowed ground, if I can call them that. And people can be inside them experience what it was like.
That's right. Fantastic. I say this only a little bit tongue in cheek, but I wanted to rebuild Independence Hall so that you could experience that history without going to Philadelphia and getting shot. Mm. I mean, they've just destroyed these.
Or beautiful... having it cloaked in red lights.
Yes.
Joe having Biden.
Your emperor is in charge image. Yeah, I just wanted to have a place where people could come experience that and also, kind of get it all in one place. And the reason I love the rotunda of the U.S. Capitol is because, those eight paintings in the rotunda basically tell the story of liberty in America and the statues and everything that's in there. And I love giving tours of the U.S. Capitol and taking people late at night into all those cool rooms, the old Supreme Court chamber and all that. But it's just gotten to be so difficult to go to places like that. And so we wanted to make it easy. It's very expensive. I mean, this is a 5 to 10 year build out before we'll have it all done. Got to raise a ton of money, all that good stuff. But Independence Hall is first on the list. We've actually already built 60,000 square feet of gun ranges, 2 10,000 square foot buildings. We've only been on the ground 90 days, Frank. We've been working around the clock.
Praise God. We have to take a short break. Sure. We're going to come back and talk about some of the work at hand, as well as the place that you're doing it. Rick Green is our guest, Patriot Academy, the guru for more and more of us. Let's praise God for his work right after this. Welcome back. We're speaking with a former Texas state legislator and a very accomplished constitutional attorney by the name of Rick Green, who, among other things, has created a formidable force for good in the form of the Patriot Academy. And we're talking about a new facility that he's just taken possession of in Fredericksburg, Texas.
where some very important training is going to be taking place. You might just mention specifically your upcoming program, Rick, and how people can find out more about it and, of course, about the Academy in general.
Yeah, patriotacademy.com, everything's there. Our immediate classes that are going to be available is the one we call Constitutional Defense. Our groundbreaking is Saturday the 22nd, and then right after that is our first class because the ranges are just finished. And that's a really fun class. You get to really get good handgun defense training during the day and then Constitution training at night. We got the best instructors on the planet. They're not drill sergeants. They really take you. You know, a lot of our people that come through have never touched a gun in their life. And frankly, crime is just out of control. You need to be able to defend yourself and your family. And it pains me, Frank, when I see schools or restaurants or whatever shot up and there's no sheepdog there to defend the innocent and defend the sheep. And so our goal is tens of thousands of just good citizens trained to be able to defend their own families. And we've done that. We've put 5,000 through that particular course so far. I want to do tens of thousands every year. And so we're headed that way. Anyway, it's a really fun course though. And 55% of the people that come through are women. A lot of people never touched a gun. Some are like me, grew up on the ranch. You know, I'd been around guns my whole life, but I'd never had real training. And the first day I realized, wow, I didn't know what I didn't know. It changed my world in a lot of ways. So I really recommend that one.
And you so this is not just for 18 to 25 year olds.
That's right. That one's 11 and up. Yeah, yeah. We're like Richard Henry Lee, signer of the Declaration. He said, you teach them when they're young how to use a firearm. And so yeah. 11 years old and up can come on that one.
Good idea. And I just want to say one of the other fringe benefits of this particular program is our friend Daniel Horowitz is
yes.
going to be in place for at least part of it. And I'd go the distance just to see him, to be honest with you, but yes. everything else sounds like it'll be very compelling as well.
Daniel loves that course. I think he's been with us probably 10 times on that course and a lot of his books come out. Yeah.
He talks very persuasively about its importance. So good on you both. And again, patriotacademy.com is where you can find out more information about all of this. Let me turn to a little bit of substance with you, Rick. One of the things that is at the core, of course, of everything you do is the Constitution of the United States. And you understand intimately its guarantees and its perishability.
Yeah.
If it is not safeguarded. I was among countless millions who swore an oath to support and defend it. I think you did as well. And yet it's under assault. And I've been talking about it with a number of our guests here. I've come to really conclude that whether they're doing business as the Great Resetters, as various international organizations, the World Health Organization, the United Nations, whether it's the World Economic Forum, whether it's a transnational criminal organization like the Chinese Communist Party, they all have in mind imposing on us, on our Constitution, something they're euphemistically calling global governance. It would be the end of our republic if that were to happen, would it not? Where somebody else is able to tell us what our public health or what our responses to various crises has to be and so on. Talk us through just how significant a danger that is.
Well, you know, if you ask people, what does freedom mean to you? Typically, they'll eventually get around to the bottom line that they get to decide major decisions for their life, for their health, for their family, for their kids, for their property, their business. It's all about who decides. And tyranny, bad government and tyranny grows in the petri dish of civic and biblical ignorance. When we do not know what makes for good government, what makes for good citizenship, when we do not know who has the sovereignty in certain areas, then we fall for the lie. And we don't know right now. We haven't taught civics in this country for decades. And so we have an ignorant population. And I don't mean that as an insult. I'm ignorant about a lot of things. I'm ignorant about many things, but I can solve that ignorance by studying that particular topic or that thing. And with civics, we're ignorant because we haven't taught that thing. So people don't even realize the power they have and what should be in their decision-making realm, what should be in the local government, state or federal government, the church, the family, all of these spheres of influence have certain authority and certain sovereignty, and we just haven't taught that in so long. And that's one reason for doing all these classes is to just get people to understand here's the realm of authority for government, and they should not do things outside that authority. And when they do, we call it unconstitutional. It almost sounds shallow now. That's literally saying it's illegal. They are violating the laws of association that we have agreed to in this country. And when it comes to the World Health Organization and these international violations of not only our national sovereignty, but our personal sovereignty, our physical well-being, our health decisions. You're exactly right. This is an existential threat. So we've got to get back to understanding who has authority to make the decisions about our personal health, about what happens in our local neighborhood, in our state, and in our nation. And to be frank, the federal government has very little authority. 17 things in the Constitution. That's it.
And enumerated powers,
and they're doing 17,000 things we never gave them the power to do. And now they want to give those 17,000 things over to a international authority. I mean, it's not getting better; it's getting worse.
Well, let me ask you. We've only got a minute left, but specifically,
yeah,
the United States Senate in recent days voted not to consider as a treaty, and therefore requiring a two-thirds consent, whatever comes out of negotiations by the World Health Organization, with the connivance, by the way, of the Biden administration, that would destroy our sovereignty.
Yeah.
By giving this outfit the right to declare public health emergencies of international concern and tell us what to do about it.
The very people supposed to be sworn to defend the Constitution are handing it over, destroying
it. And have that specific responsibility, 30 yeah. seconds, on why that is outrageous.
It's civic ignorance on their part. Even United States senators do not understand this. Even they do not know their role as a senator under the Constitution. It's not enough to just do education. We've got to do action as well. It's why what you're doing with the Sovereignty Coalition is so important. But let's get educated. Let's take action. And folks, it's time to make sacrifices. We've got to get more involved.
Amen. SovereigntyCoalition.org is where you can find out more about this. Rick has just joined us. We're very pleased to say thank you for your leadership on all these fronts and the incredible investment you're making in helping all of us be better citizens. God bless you and your work.
Thanks to you
all for joining us for this edition of Securing America. I hope you feel better equipped to help us protect the country we love. Until the next time, that you'll go forth and multiply.